It is very unusual for a scholar to identify a subject of manifestly great importance that has barely been addressed. But Eric Lowy's recently published Rashi's Commentary on the Torah, Canonization and Resistance in the Reception of a Jewish Classic, has succeeded in doing so. So writes Professor David Berger, reviewing Lowy's book in Tradition's recent spring 2021 issue. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Jeffrey Sachs. Our guest today is Eric Lowy, professor of Bible at Bar-Ilan University, where he specializes in Jewish biblical interpretation in modern and medieval times. I'm talking to him about his new book, Exploring Rashi's Torah Commentary, the most classic work of the most classic mode of Jewish scholarship, how it came to occupy the place in Jewish life and learning. It could be said that we are students of the Bible and Talmud, for that matter, as read by and transmitted to us through Rashi's commentaries. But was it inevitable that the hermeneutical canon, as Lowy calls it, had to develop that way? Please subscribe to the Tradition Podcast on all the regular platforms and leave us a 5-star review to help us spread the word about our work at Tradition. And of course, visit traditiononline.org, where you can renew your subscription to our quarterly print journal or gift a subscription, perhaps to a young person in your life who should be engaging with our Journal of Orthodox Jewish Thought. And now, Eric Lowy, welcome to the Tradition Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
All traditionally educated Jews have learned Rashi. At some point, almost all have consulted and learned and studied the many so-called super commentaries, commentaries on Rashi's commentary. But what may be surprising for some of our listeners is that until now, and until your new book from Oxford University Press, the genre of exploring commentaries on Rashi's commentary has gone largely unexplored, at least certainly not by seriously scholarly investigation. We take for granted the centrality and status of Perush Rashi, of Rashi's commentary on the Torah, so much so that we rarely consider the process by which it achieved that status, or maybe even the parallel universe, the Twilight Zone episode of Jewish learning in which it might have been different. Most of us, of course, know the Perushim, the commentaries of Ibn Ezra and Ramban, both of whom critically engage Rashi, but don't write commentaries on Rashi per se. In your book, you note that Ramban's approach set a kind of agenda for much of the discussion of the commentaries on Rashi that would come after him. But in terms of that world, of that universe of commentary on Rashi, help us understand, give us a map, give us the back of the envelope version of what you've so skillfully done in the book. Help us understand the world of commentaries on the commentary of Rashi.
Well, that's a vast universe, and as you rightly noted, scholars somehow have missed that part of the cosmos when it comes to classical Jewish learning, though. Stops to reflect on it will note that some of the great Rashi super commentators are among the Gedolei Yisrael of the late medieval and early modern period, and the genre really continues down to the present in many new manifestations and often in multiple languages. But starting a bit at the beginning, as you suggest we ought to, one thinks about Rashi as, of course, the founder of a school in Northern France, after having studied at the great Ashkenazi yeshivot in Germany. And many of his successors were famously members of his own family, but he also attracted students from abroad. It was, of course, very natural for them, after the commentary on the Torah in particular, which is the focus of my book, was published, for them to reflect on Rashi's selections of Midrashim. Sometimes perhaps they pondered how it was that Rashi got from what was written in a pasuk, in a verse, to a given interpretation. Perhaps they also thought about some of the ideas that lay behind some of these sometimes very enigmatic Midrashic ideas that he cited. So on some level, I suppose that it was a fairly informal and very natural process that gave rise to initial reflections on Rashi's commentary and the milieu in which it was originally written. One of the things that I tried to speak about in the book is that Rashi was, of course, fantastically successful and relatively quickly spread to other centers of Jewish learning, where the paideia, where the educational modes and spiritual aspirations were often quite different from those that would have been familiar to someone growing up in an Ashkenazic or Northern European milieu. And so at that point, you sort of have a process of engagement that's quite different. And as you mentioned, if one takes Sfarad, the other sort of antipode often of Ashkenazic Jewish learning in terms of the way we think about the period of, let's say, the Rishonim, Ramban is an obvious figure to exemplify that particular process. On the one hand, he feels that Rashi makes a claim on him. He often begins his own comments by quoting Lashon Rabbeinu Shlomo. These are the words of Rabbeinu Shlomo. He actually doesn't call him Rashi, but Rabbeinu Shlomo, although in certain editions it appears as Rashi. It's been changed. And then he'll engage with that comment. But typically the upshot is going to be some dissent from what Rashi had to say. Presumably, if he agreed or fully identified with what Rashi said, he would have little reason to comment at all. Often that dissent will be introduced by Alder Hapshat, because one of the great points of tension and contention when it came to Rashi's commentary was the degree to which he did rely on rabbinic ideas, Midrashic teachings and interpretations to explicate and expound the Torah. And Ramban, who's a product of the Spanish school and is very aware of Ibn Ezra, you also mentioned, a great exemplar of Derech HaPshat, will often find that Rashi's interpretation, while perhaps valid midrashically, leaves much to be desired from the point of view of plain sense interpretation. So you have that sort of engagement, but as you said, that's still not a systematic commentary on Rashi. The story of systematic commentaries, and one would have to define the genre a little bit, which we won't take time to do now, is really a late medieval phenomenon. And if you want to sort of define it very strictly and narrowly as a work that engages exclusively with Rashi's comments in a systematic way, then I would say the great systematic commentaries are written not in Ashkenaz, but in late medieval Spain, which is something of a surprising development. It means that Rashi won the day not only in his own sort of cultural domain and backyard, but also in a place that might have been expected to have been highly antithetical or even antagonistic,
Hostile.
Hostile towards Rashi. In some cases, such hostility was expressed, albeit usually with terms of respect. Rashi was, after all, Rashi, and as you mentioned, he had his reputation not only as the great Torah commentator, but as the commentator on the Talmud. But that's where it gets started. The heyday of Rashi's super commentary, just to sort of finish out the thought, is really the early modern period, depending on how you define that. But the commentary that becomes a point of departure for many, many later super commentators is that of Eliyahu Mizrahi, great Ottoman rabbi, and then in Ashkenaz in the 16th, 17th centuries and forward and following, you have some of the classic super commentaries. People will perhaps know the Gur Aryeh of Maharal and the work of Mordechai Yaffe, Lavush Olah, and that really becomes almost a substitute for direct Torah commentary. First of all, in those centuries, you have someone like the Kli Yakar, Efraim Lunshitz, who does write a Torah commentary, but even that mentions Rashi frequently. Otherwise, Rashi has now become the sort of intermediary, you might say, between the divine word and the Ashkenazic reader of early modern and modern times. And he does get taught in Ashkenazic yeshivot. So in addition to written super commentaries, there's that oral dimension, an oral tradition, Torah Sheba'al Peh, where a Rashi yeshiva will give a shir on the Chumash on a Thursday night. But to give a shir on the Chumash almost invariably means to also do it
Through the
with famous Rashi in hand.
intermediary of Rashi. Well, in other
Correct.
words, what one of the ideas that comes out clearly from reading the book is that what we, what Jews today know about Midrash, a major genre of rabbinic literature, after all, has been largely determined by the selection made by one man in the 11th century. You suggest that Rashi's work in formulating the commentary played a major role, not only as commentary per se, but as a kind of, I guess, cultural agent, a source through which those ideas and that realm of rabbinic midrash passed over into our knowledge and possession today, both in his selection, but also in the way that he reformulated many of those midrashic teachings. And that midrash, as it were, the midrashic literature, as served up to us through Rashi, shaped all types of Jewish ideas and sensibilities and perceptions of what reading the Torah is. So could you explain a little more about that and maybe give an example or two of how this has played out in Rashi leaving his fingerprints, as it were, on Jewish thought and sensibilities in our lives?
Also a large question, and I would say multidimensional. There's sort of an educational side to it, how the Torah is taught in many a classroom and down to our own times, from the kindergarten classroom to the advanced shiur, if there is an advanced shiur in Parshat Teshuvah in a post-secondary yeshiva. There's a halachic dimension because of the fascinating development, which I think had more impact than people perhaps realized, that Rashi could become either a substitute for Targum in fulfilling the halachic requirement of Shnai Mikra Ve'echad Targum, to read the Parsha privately each week, fully twice in the original and once with some substitute originally in Chazal. That means reading an Aramaic translation, which would have been an aid to people who maybe struggled with the Hebrew, but over time, Aramaic having become obsolete, Rashi becomes a possible substitute. I won't go into the details of who argued that view, but it does become an object of halachic psak in the Torah and Shulchan Aruch. So many, many dimensions to it. And yes, I think if you want to take the opposite approach for a moment, you could ask how many Midrashim are famous in the world of, average Jewish learning, not talking about leading elite scholars that aren't in Perush Rashi. I think there are some, but I imagine it would be a handful, and that most of the Midrashim that people would rhyme off as sort of part of their notion of what the Torah's message is to us would be ones that we, we would all recognize as having been in Perush Rashi. Needless to say, if one asks about Avraham and how it is that he was chosen by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Lech Lecha Me'artzecha, Me'lavecha Me'beit Avicha, why him and not someone else? Well, even a pre-literate kindergartner will probably be able to tell you something about how he smashed the idols of his father, was brought to a Nimrod as a result, was thrown into the fiery furnace. That is to say, had already proved himself at the end of chapter 11, as it were, before chapter 12 of Genesis even starts. Meaning to say, between the lines of chapter 11, as recounted by Rashi, he had proved himself. And Rashi there does have, his point of departure there is al panei terech aviv. He does have a plain sense interpretation, which just means, starting at the beginning of the story, Avraham's brother, who passed away in his father's lifetime. That's the pshat, according to Rashi. But that's probably not what most people are going to remember about Rashi's comment on that verse. Right. What they will remember is the Midrash Agadah, as he calls it there, the Midrashic elaboration. So those things become sort of osmosed into the sort of consciousness of the nation, you almost might say, so that when the story gets retold, as you well know, as a leading educator, sometimes people will forget exactly where this text stops and Rashi begins.
One wonders if Rashi, in his wildest dreams for the success of the Perush, was aware of that potential danger of blurring the lines between text and commentary, and what the long lasting impact of his work becoming canonized itself would have
Yeah,
been.
that's an interesting question, and I guess one could then follow through on that thought and wonder how much it would have troubled him. It's often hard to get, Rashi is so self-effacing that it's sometimes hard to get behind questions like that in terms of trying to think through what he might have said about those sorts of interesting and quite important pedagogic issues.
In his review in Tradition, David Berger identifies the most original section. He calls it the most original section of an already original study as your introduction to a series of works authored in mostly in the Eastern Mediterranean that subject Rashi's commentary to withering criticism. These are Rashi's what you call resisting readers. We're used to asking the question, perhaps influenced by the work of Nechama Leibovitz, what's bothering Rashi? But here we have to ask, what's bothering these resistors about Rashi? So tell us something of these commentaries, most of whom we must say did not win the day, have not knocked Rashi off his pedestal, and frankly, many of them are unknown to them, and many of their writings are not even widely available. But who were they, and what was animating them in their resistance to Rashi?
In some cases, we know relatively little about who they were, and at least one prominent case that gets, I think, the longest chapter in that central section of the book. We're talking about someone who wrote under a pseudonym. Despite my best efforts, I cannot tell you, who he was and exactly where he lived. You mentioned that there's some surmise on my part, which I obviously try to document, that there's likely Eastern Mediterranean provenance for these works, and we can maybe mention a reason or two about why that might be. But sort of zooming out a little bit, I think the way to see them as part of a larger debate, you might say, sometimes a raging debate in the Jewish Middle Ages about, what is classical Judaism? What is the legacy of Tanakh and Chazal? And what is it we're trying to perpetuate? And what are the sort of dangers that authentic Judaism faces? These are, of course, to put in those terms, debates that have not abated in our own time. And among the great alternatives that Jews can look back to already by the 13th, 14th, 15th centuries, when these figures begin to make an appearance, is the sort of great rationalist alternative, which emanates in large measure from Sfarad, although it has a basis in developments in the Gaonic East. Without doubt, the heroic figure for people who take their inspiration from that form of rationalist Judaism, which is in touch with the latest scientific developments, building off of Greco-Arabic philosophic ideas, is Rambam, is Maimonides. And so to some extent, there's a natural pull to view Maimonides and Rashi as representatives of two sort of different forms of Judaism. I would say, in terms of this rationalist alternative, the other figure to mention here is Avraham Ibn Ezra, because after all, the Rambam did not write a running commentary on Tanakh or any book of Tanakh. There's much material that did inspire later systematic Bible commentators in the more in the Vuchim. So if you think about it in terms of these two paradigms, you might say, of Judaism, where Rashi is much more in touch with classic texts, but certainly not aware of the latest Aristotelian ideas. I always tell my students, if you ask Rashi, what do you think of Aristotle, what would his answer be? And his answer would be, of course, who's Aristotle? There's not even a name that people know. And yet, as the crow flies, Spain is not very far away. And people are immersed in this world of ideas and see it not just as sort of a foreign accretion, but as very much central to one's understanding of what the Torah is trying to teach us, and even what certain Ma'amarei Chazal intended to say when they spoke in the sometimes cryptic ways that they spoke. So these critics, and they are, as you say, in sometimes shockingly harsh in their rhetoric, and that's part of what's surprising, what sets them off, say, from someone like Ranban, who can be critical, but as I said, was almost always, quite respectful. What sets them off, in addition to the rhetoric, is the fact that they are an especially uncompromising version, often, of the ideals they see embodied in Ibn Ezra and Rambam. What are those ideals? One is a very strongly Pshatist approach to the text, which finds Midrash at a very far remove from what the text actually means, quote unquote. And the other is that they insist that a sine qua non for a proper understanding of the Torah is to have some serious training in fields like logic, physics, metaphysics, and so on and so forth. So you have something of a two-pronged attack, depending on the writer, and one will focus on the sort of interpretive textual issue, is this Pshuto Shel Mikra? And often the finding is very much in the negative when it comes to Rashi's interpretations. The second one is this something we can really believe, these midrashim that sometimes Rashi adduces, which take a text which is already shot through with, say, Nisim, with miracles, and makes it yet more miraculous? Right. And they say, we believe in a world where observable nature essentially retains its enduring character, unless a Kodesh Baruch Hu has to intervene for some very important reason and split a sea. On the whole, we're wedded to a view where God doesn't play dice with the universe, to use a modern expression, and hence they are determined to interpret the texts in ways that are very much inimical to a world where Rashi sees a Kodesh Baruch Hu intervening freely as an omnipotent God surely can do from the point of view of those who espouse that view. So those, I would say, are the sort of general angles of resistance to Rashi's commentary, and they're born of a sort of very different type of paradigm of Judaism, which takes inspiration from different heroes than Rashi and Ashkenaz in general.
We rarely truly understand why we're interested in the things that interest us, but I'm curious why, you dedicated many years of research and writing and exploring and thinking to produce this this important book. Why focus more on the resistors to Rashi than on the embracers? You know, what's important in producing a detailed study of the critical works about Rashi, again, many of which were hardly read and many of which are unknown today?
I guess there's always the pull of the novel. And some sense, I think that it's a valuable service that Jewish studies scholarship can perform that sometimes is very unlikely to occur in the setting of, say, a classical yeshiva, to expand the spectrum of alternatives that we're aware of. Doesn't mean we have to subscribe to them, but that we should at least sometimes be aware of the range of options out there that have been handed down to us from the classical past. I would add that some of these critics seem to be people of tremendous learning themselves, and it seems to me sort of an act of Chesed Shel Emet, I suppose you could say, and Tchiyat HaMeitim, to revive their writings and to indicate that, in addition to the sort of classical commentators whom we all recognize and certainly are worthy of our attention, Rashbam, Ibn Ezra, and Ban, the corpus of Jewish Bible commentary is perhaps quite a bit broader than we imagine. But that doesn't discount the necessity to focus on some of the admirers of Rashi. The book actually started off more as one that focused on critics. Mm-hmm. And over time, I did expand it to discuss this super commentary phenomenon, in part as sort of two sides of the same coin. And I think that was a real revelation to me at some point. It's obvious that someone like Mizrahi, who devotes so much time and energy to interpreting Rashi, and he says in some of his tshuvot that this was basically, from his point of view, this was the pièce de la résistance. This was the the major work that he was determined to finish at the end of his life. He was struggling to put final touches on. He tells one of his correspondents, I just don't have time for anything else. I'm really trying to get this commentary done on Rashi. That's certainly a clear indication of the veneration of Rashi, the valorization of his commentary. But what I think was especially interesting to me is to come to understand that attacks on a figure are also a type of valorization.
Sure.
That is to say, somebody
whose ideas
who,
are worthy enough to engage with.
Exactly. Worthy and also, you might say, troubling enough in the sense that they are proving influential. Mm-hmm. And if you have a different vision of what Jewish life is meant to be, what our core concerns ought to be, what is the equipment we ought to bring to our thinking about Judaism and Torah interpretation and so forth. And you begin to see that Rashi is spreading, and you fear that as something of a troubling prospect for the future of your faith. So then you may choose to devote time and energy to attacking some of that. Is to say, that too, it turns out, is only a proof of the canonization of a text, the fact that it tracks. And in the first chapter of the book, when I talk about what comprises a canonical or a classic text, one of the theories that I discussed there, based on the South African novelist of all people, is that a text in a way can't even become a classic unless it gets attacked and survives. And Rashi did that in spades and splendidly, that looking back, Rashi has nothing to worry about from, as you say, these minor figures who no one's ever heard of, and is still going strong, and as best one can tell, promises to be going strong for a good long time to come.
You end the book with a kind of explanation of, you know, Rashi's victory, you know, particularly over, I mean, certainly over these minor, now largely forgotten figures, but even over distinguished rivals such as Ibn Ezra and Ramban, and for that matter, the whole Maimonidean approach to biblical interpretation. So why could those competing works, even Ramban, the most successful as Torah commentator, why could those competing approaches never have achieved the widespread sweeping popularity and influence as Bible commentaries of that produced by Rashi?
That's a fascinating question, isn't it? And you know, part of it, I suppose, is Rashi has a je ne sais quoi quality that, you know, is undefinable but indomitable. But one can, I think, point to certain specific characteristics of Rashi's commentary, you know, which did allow it to win a day, or you might say negatively, some of the characteristics of those other commentaries that did not allow them to be a substitute for Peirush Rashi on the Torah. Starting perhaps with the latter, Ibn Ezra, for those who have ever tried to crack through some of his comments, is famously recondite and laconic. What?
Takes time and energy.
Time and energy, and you know, sometimes is deliberately cryptic, a muskil yidom, and so on and so forth. For some people, that becomes a source of inspiration to crack the code, but for others, it's like, well, if you don't want to tell me anything, I can go back to Rashi, who has nothing esoteric about him, at least on the surface. You know, some of his midrashim may seem a little esoteric sometimes, but in terms of his pitch to people, it's very much you know, open to all comers, I suppose you would say. You know, I think it's clear that the Midrashic reading of the Torah has a certain attraction that the plain sense simply does not have. And for all that one might thrill to a grammatical comment of Ibn Ezra or Rashbam, it's probably going to always be a circumscribed number of people who will find that gripping, whereas Rashi's Midrashic reading was, you know, on the one hand, something one could impart to the newest initiates in Torah learning. On the other hand, you know, full of food for thought for those who ponder them. I sometimes think that we skip over some of the Midrashim, you know, a little too quickly. I like to quote the Midrash, you know, when the brothers bring back the Ketonet Tepasim to Yaakov, and he says, Chaya Ra'achalatu, right? And Rashi there has a few Midrashim that he brings, won't talk about all of them, but the one that I always find most interesting is, Rashi asked the question, why did not HaKadosh Baruch Hu tell Yaakov that Yosef was still alive, spare him decades of anguish over this son who he believed had been lost to him? And he says, Shechrimu v'kilalu, the brothers had made a cherem, and they had included HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the cherem, v'shitfu l'HaKadosh Baruch Hu imahem. And you ask yourself, what does that mean to say that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is included in some cherem of the brothers? But the more you think about it, the more you realize, yes, many times that's exactly what happens. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives people free will and they do all sorts of wrongheaded things, and he's included in the mess and can't necessarily, quote unquote, intervene by his own choice about how to create the world. I mean, these sorts of things are not necessarily the sorts of ideas that you would find in every last commentator. So from the youngest to the most sophisticated, Rashi had something to offer. And, you know, that's at least part of his charm, part of his
Success.
appeal.
Yeah. We've been engaging with the Torah through the prism of Rashi for almost 1,000 years. I assume in 1,000 years from now, people will be doing the same. What do you imagine the future of Rashi commentary and super commentary? Can you foresee a future wave of resisting readers to Rashi, and what might that look like at some point in the future? Of course, with all the codicils about the hard thing about talking about the future is that we don't know what's going to happen.
Right. Not a question I'd ever thought about, so I'm glad you asked it. Something I would now try to think about more. I think it is an interesting question, especially, in the circles in which you move for educators, since Rashi continues, I think, to be a staple in many traditional, Jewish settings, schools, and so forth.
I
And,
think in almost all.
yeah, and I guess it would be an interesting question, maybe something worthy of a survey sometime. How exactly does Rashi play among, say, your average high school student in greater New York area and or downtown Jerusalem? I would say, I have a database of one, which is my daughter, who's now in grade 8, and there are times I would say that the impression I get is that she does find it hard to relate to certain aspects of Peirush Rashi, and that there might be a place in places where he is the sole focus to try to diversify the range of commentators for two reasons. One, they may hit students in places where Rashi does not speak to students existentially in ways that Rashi perhaps does not, but also, of course, to send a message in our pluralist age that. Rashi, for all that he became highly influential, certainly the most influential word in Jewish Bible commentary, certainly not did not become the final word in Jewish Bible commentary. The great testament to that is the page of the Mikra Gedolot, which I always consider a huge, victory of a sort in an age that didn't define itself as pluralist for a view that says we're not afraid of multiple voices.
Sharing space on the
Standing
same page.
alongside each other, yeah, on the same on the same on the same page. In terms of super commentary trends, as you say, I don't have any crystal ball, but it is interesting to note that one can point to works in English now, in French now, certainly in Hebrew, which carry on this legacy from the past. And if you were asking me to name a modern day commentator who works extensively with Rashi in very creative ways, I would think of Aviva Zornberg, who frequently draws on Chazal, of course, but in many cases on Rashi, and sometimes, as you alluded to earlier, specific formulations of Rashi that tweak or inflect rabbinic ideas in a way that leaves his distinctive stamp on the idea. So
That's
that is really the remarkable thing, as you say, almost a millennium on after Rashi ceased putting pen to paper. This is an achievement which I'm not acquainted with every last writer in every last culture, but there cannot be too many writers in the history of humankind who could lay claim to such an achievement. And I think it's something that, if my book did anything, I hope it does this, allows us to step back and admire, somewhat astonished, that Rashi managed to achieve this
If
feat.
there are written works in other cultures that 900, nearly 1,000 years after they were written, continue to occupy a culture, there surely are then even very fewer, if any at all, where that culture engages with that text from, as you said, sometimes pre-kindergarten till old age, and at every stage along the way. That's another very remarkable thing about the commentary of Rashi.
Right, absolutely. Those are the marks of Rashi, which really set him apart, not just from every other Jewish writer, but maybe, as you suggest, from even the greatest figures of world literature and world literature and thought. So we should be grateful that we have him as part of our canon.
The book concludes with a very, very brief but I think, fascinating afterward, in which you explore some of Rashi's contemporary effects and impacts and points of fascination from modern figures, from ranging from David Ben-Gurion to Shai Agnon to Art Scroll, and as you mentioned, Viva Zornberg. So say a word about Rashi's place in contemporary Jewish life and engagement with him amongst contemporary writers and thinkers and culture.
That's a sort of 8-page let's talk about the last 500 years in short order afterward. And to some extent, I guess it was written to set the stage for what I think ought to be the next book in the series. I'm not sure I'm going to be the one to write it, and that is, what happened after the period where I stop in the book, 16th century roughly, which also includes the age of print, something worth noting in terms of how new technologies affect Rashi in our age. One can ask about Rashi on the internet. But I think the sense one would have is that Rashi must have suffered a huge decline in the period of modernity with the fragmentation of Jewish identity and so on and so forth. I do talk about aspects of that, Spinoza through Ben-Gurion. The pitch of that afterward is really to show, I would say, his abiding contemporaneity in many quarters of the Jewish world. I don't think we could say that he's sort of universally recognized among, say, North American Jewish denominations as the commentator, but his surprising ability to speak to large segments of world Jewry down to this day. And another feature of that very fleeting discussion is to try to unpack the different premises on the basis of which he's approached. And that is a theme, I would say, throughout the book, that what you get out of Rashi depends on the assumptions that you have when you go in. And that's, of course, true of any text that one absorbs and adapts and sifts. So in the case of Art Scroll, just to pick up on one example that you mentioned, they have a remarkable, in their edition of Rashi, they have in the introduction a remarkable passage where they basically say that Rashi, functionally at least, should be treated as the equivalent of scripture, or the way they put it, that you should read Rashi the way Rashi read the Torah, which is to say, to assume that every word and every letter counts. And that's despite the fact that they're aware of different girsa'ot in Rashi, different versions of Rashi, but nonetheless to make that assumption. So that's an interesting set of premises that they bring to the text. Not every last person would make that assumption, but I think that would be part of the story, which would be to see how different approaches to Rashi in the 18th, 19th, 20th, and now the 21st century open a window on different larger aspects of Jewish culture and developments within Jewish thought and literature.
Rashi's commentary on the Torah, canonization and resistance in the reception of a Jewish classic by Professor Eric Lowy, published by Oxford University Press, reviewed in the most recent issue of Tradition by Professor David Berger, available online at traditiononline.org. Read it there and listen to Professor David Berger say that we owe Lowy a debt of gratitude for his sweeping, learned, and original contribution to our understanding of how Rashi's classic text achieved its well-deserved renown. Thank you, Eric Lowy.
Pleasure, thank you.